Every episode of The Gauge is brought to you by Bill Fick Ford and the WCRA. Guys, Bill Fick Ford is the number one Super Duty dealer in the country for the fourth year in a row. You guys have heard me rant and rave about Bill Fick Ford for the absolute best buying experience in the car industry, truck industry. Bill Fick Ford's the place to go. I bet you remember the old ad where I said I was getting a new Super Duty. Well, here's the keys for that. Bill Fick Ford delivers, guys. Noble discounts, noble interest rates, the best buying experience you can get. And if you are not local to Huntsville or the Houston area, he'll deliver it to you just like he did to me. Bill Fick Ford. Rodeo Corpus Christi has nearly tripled its added prize money from 2019 and will be one of the largest payout rodeos this summer. That's $545,000 with no entry fees. Rodeo Corpus Christi will be the first stop of WCRA's Triple Crown of Rodeo. The only way to qualify for the Rodeo Corpus Christi is by nominating your rides and runs with the WCRA. You can win $1 million by nominating your rides and runs and earning points with the WCRA. Through the Triple Crown of Rodeo, the WCRA will award this $1 million cash prize to any one athlete or collective of athletes who win first place at any three consecutive WCRA major rodeos. A common misconception with the WCRA is that it is only for the pros. That's the farthest thing from the truth. It's designed for the underdogs to have their fair chance. If you feel like you have the ability to compete against the best in the world, but maybe you don't feel like it. Maybe you can't afford to go down the road for a full year. Maybe you got a job. Well, the WCRA is made for you. The WCRA has awarded more than $8.5 million to rodeo athletes in just a couple of years. To learn more, visit WCRARodeo.com and learn how you can earn a spot at Rodeo Corpus Christi and possibly be rodeo's next millionaire.
This is The Gauge with host Chance Conradude.
Are you freaking serious? It's Conrado. This is The Gauge, and I am Chance Conrado on this episode of the podcast. Happy International Women's Day. We did exactly what we should do on International Women's Day and invited a male rail racer on the show. Brandon Cullen's in the house. Check it out. All right, Brandon, how's it going?
Pretty good. How are you?
Well, I'm hanging in there. I think it's kind of interesting that Day of the Woman, International Women's Day. We got a male bell racer in here. Yeah. It's kind of ironic considering all the, you know, this is obviously something you've heard a million times, and I have also heard it a million times. Yeah.
I didn't know it hurt that many people's feelings.
Isn't it weird that it does? Yeah. It was so crazy because it got highlighted so much while you were going through the American, just freaking weirdos coming out of the woodwork, just yeah, freaking out.
We have a group chat with my brother and my cousins, and they don't have anything to do with horses.
Yeah.
And he sends me a picture of this guy with, like, older guy with a handlebar mustache and says, "Hey, Brandon, I don't think this guy wants you to run barrels."
It's funny, like, how ignorant these guys are. And we've been talking about doing this for months and months, and it's kind of tough when someone lives all the way in Maryland.
Yeah.
But, I cannot understand, because it's not the other women. And no. I mean, I was raised by a male barrel racer, and that sounds weird to say it. When you say male barrel racer, it was like, that's not a thing. You're just a horse trainer, and it happens to be barrel horses. And I never understood that. It's always bothered me. And I've gotten literal fist fights over it, like defending people for whatever reason, because I just don't like it. It doesn't make sense. But when you see that stuff, what is your answer? What is your response personally? I mean, you're one of the top guys going now in this era, and it'd be interesting to hear what your answer to that is.
Well, I never knew it was a thing.
Yeah. Like,
on the East Coast, everybody that I've watched and looked up to were men that ran barrels. I mean, Cody, Troy, Brett, Kibo, all
the list goes on. Chris Coffey back in the day, yeah.
Yeah. And they're, until I came out here in like 2015 or 14, the first time I came out here, I didn't know it was weird. So I never knew any different.
How did you get into it, though? I mean, being in Maryland, when I think of Maryland, my first thought isn't, wow, booming barrel horse community.
Yeah, it's not.
Yeah.
There's a handful of us, but not too many.
I'm thinking clams or some fish life.
New Blue England crabs. Clams.
Yeah. Blue crabs, that's what we got. But I don't know, my family has a farm there, and they didn't really have animals or anything. My aunt rode horses. They had a couple horses and got some. And then I started riding with them. And then I kind of got bored of just riding around the farm. And there's like 4-H shows around the home. I started going to those, and they had barrel races at it. And, well, I wanted to rope after kind of watching and seeing stuff, but there's nobody around close to me that I could find that did it. And then went to those 4-H shows and ran barrels at them, and then met a woman that did the MBHAs and kind of rode around with her for a while, and then went to a couple of futurities and liked it, and then that's decided what I wanted to do and didn't really want to get a real job, so went with that.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. It's kind of a traditional path in my family too, and so I can relate to it. And we actually lived on the, we lived in North Carolina, and I'll never forget, you go to those huge barrel races on the weekend, there's 400 or 500 people entered, but there's about 150 men entered. Yeah. And so it was the same thing for me. It's like, in fact, barrel racing is more prominent on the East Coast than anything else. They don't really, at least in the days we lived there, they didn't really pay attention to pro rodeo that much.
No, there's not much on the East Coast like that for rodeo. Emily was up, she's in Maryland now with me, and she went to a couple, and there's not, I don't know, maybe 15 or 20 a year that you could go to, and you kind of had to go all year and all over the, like from Maine to Florida to get to them.
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. So, I mean, you kind of made that decision, right? But what age was it where you're like, man, I could actually be a force in this industry? Because you, I mean, you are one of the more new era guys, right? A lot of those guys you've been talking about, like the Troy Crumrines of the world, have been going at it for 30 years. I mean, before we had like real internet, you'd see his name on like a Barrel Horse News, and not a lot of people out here. Well, I bet nobody out here really knew who Troy Crumrine was, but on the East Coast, legendary.
Yeah, he's definitely the best. But I don't know. I'm still not sure I'm making any money doing it or really need to. I don't know. You say I'm that good, but sometimes it doesn't feel that way. But I don't know. I mean, like I said, I never really wanted to get a real job. I just love being out there and riding, and when that all comes together, it feels, it's a good feeling, kind of like a drug. So I don't know really when that happened. I guess 2014, 15, I had a colt, was about, stayed out with your dad for about a month, probably out there. Well, funny story about that, I was out there and I think it was Eads, Colorado, maybe to at a rodeo grounds pretty close to Hudson, or maybe it's one of those.
Yeah,
but I was out there, I had sucker punch as a three-year-old, and I was struggling with him pretty hard, and Kelly jumps on him and runs him through the barrels and like doesn't do anything, and he just turns all three perfect, and I mean was running and looked perfect. And I could not figure it out. Like, I couldn't get myself to do what he did on the horse. And I remember sitting on the fence thinking, I owned, like, two horses there, and I had the rest for customer horses. I could sell my two horses, sell the truck and trailer, ship the customer horses back home and quit and fly back, because I was just getting so frustrated. But by the end of it, things started clicking, and then that's probably really when everything turned around, and I started feeling a little more comfortable on them and kind of started making runs. And then Sucker Punch ended up being pretty good, and I had the Foxy Stinson horse then, and she started winning. So probably about then is when it really set in that maybe I could do this.
Before that, because I mean, that's kind of like a pivotal moment. Like if you're writing a book on your life, like that's a pivotal moment. You're thinking, I'm going to quit. I'm not going to do this anymore.
Yeah.
Because of this and this, which I mean, all of us have sat on the barrel in the barrel patch with Kelly. I mean, yeah. So many legendary people have and had that same feeling. He's actually a really good teacher.
Yeah.
And it takes a lot for me to give him compliments sometimes just because that's our relationship. But, that's just interesting. How long had you been taking outside horses before you got to that specific moment in our little story here?
Probably, I want to say like the first time I went to Oklahoma City was 2007. And I think I had horses, but not like back home. Nobody really sent futurity horses. It was just, here's this 13-year-old random horse and go get it, turn around the barrels. So like I had those probably about 2005 or so. Since then I had kind of those, and then I'd say maybe 2010 or 12 is when I really started riding like horses to train for futurities.
So you're at Kelly's place, you're doing this thing, and you hit this moment where you're like, I don't think I can do it. And then something clicks, something goes, and then you start winning. And then all of a sudden people are starting to recognize you. What was it like for you? You know, because anybody who does barrel racing or ropes, I mean, I've had the fortune of doing both quite a bit, but, it does something weird to you when you go and you win money.
Yeah.
In any horse discipline, or probably anything, really. That just happens to be our industry, and we don't know much other than that. But, what was the first big check you won where you're like, damn, and who did you who were you riding against that just really made it all set in for you?
Well, the first big thing I won that I had, like, kind of meant something to me was the probably Congress, the junior barrels, which, funny enough, it really doesn't pay any money, maybe a couple hundred dollars. But the junior barrels there is always, like, really tough, and that was the first, like, aged event I kind of won, and that was probably the biggest thing that I thought that was when I was like, yeah, this is what I want to do. There's other stuff, like open horses that I won a little bit here and there, but that's probably the first big thing I won in my mind anyway.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. When you started winning the fraternities, though, I mean, you were going against just legends, right? I mean, still do. Like, if you enter those, there's going to be Cassie Mowry's there. Troy's still going to be there. Jolene's going to be there. Ashley's going to be there. You name it. If you know the barrel racers, they're going to be there. And your name's in that group with these people now, right? I mean, that's – what does that make you feel like, I wonder?
A little surreal, and I don't know. I don't really think about it too much. I still – in my mind, put them way above me, like, watch them, and still, like, Cody, me and him are really, Bowser, man, me and him are real good friends. Another kind of moment like that, one winter I stayed in Unadilla, Georgia, at Bob Hamilton's place, and Cody was there for the winter, too, and I learned a lot from him, just watching him ride and picking his brain and stuff. So, like, I don't know, I was talking to him this morning about, or last night, I guess it was, we were talking about how working colts or something, I did something different than he told me to do, and it felt like it helped a couple of my colts this morning, and I was texting him about that, but so I don't know, it's still, I don't ever think you're done, so I don't know, I guess I still hold them kind of above me anyway.
Yeah, that makes sense. Let's go back to the whole Women's Day thing and talking about male barrel racing, because it's just a big topic, right? And I don't think a lot of people have talked about it super realistically, right? Which I feel like you and I could do that. Does it bother you? I mean, because it always bothered me so much, right? Like, I would get, and I'll be very honest and transparent. Like, there's a lot of people who listen to this, but I used to exercise or go to barrel races with Kelly every weekend from the time I was, I don't know, like 6 years old until I was 18, when I was like, I'm not doing this. And I mean, we did. You had the BFA, everything. We took horses, and I also roped. Right. I also roped high school rodeo, did the whole thing, roped a lot. And it just, no matter what you do, for whatever reason, like, oh, your dad's a barrel horse trainer. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? At least where we grew up. It's not that way on the East Coast, but it certainly is this half of the country where it's just such a taboo, unacceptable thing for a man to race a horse in three circles, but it's not in a straight line. Jockeys aren't ridiculed that way. You know, I'll never understand the whole thing outside of the GRA and the WPRA being set up for women, but I mean, does it bother you? Does it get under your skin?
To be honest, no.
Yeah.
I don't really think about it, and where we're going all the time, well, I never really see it except on Facebook, and I hardly get on Facebook. The only reason I knew anything was really going on was my brother sent me that picture.
Yeah.
Just joking. And then Donna Kay said something to me about it, but I didn't know there was all that stuff was going on. But, I mean, everywhere we go to the futurities and stuff, it's not a thing in that, like in the futurity world.
No, at least it's not a thing at all.
Say it to us anyway. I mean, a lot of people, I'm friends with Jolene and Ashley and all of them, they never have any problem with it.
No, it's only rodeo, right? Oh, yeah. It's only if you get into the rodeo circles that it seems to be this thing, this issue for whatever reason. Maybe it's men who aren't comfortable enough in their own skin. I don't know what it is, dude. It's just freaking weird, and it drives me insane.
Well, you know, even at the American a couple of days ago, where you got everybody there that's kind of like at the high end of it, maybe some of them are bothered by it, but the ones that talked to me didn't, and that were team ropers or bull riders or anybody, like they don't look at me funny.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think they can – anybody that's at that level, no matter what you do, I think they can have a mutual respect for somebody that's also at that same level, no matter what it is that they're doing.
And you know what it might be? I guess I'm thinking about this out loud while you're saying this, is it might be the fact that real horsemen recognize real horsemen, right?
Yeah.
There's something about, it doesn't matter if it's team roping, if it's tie down, that if you're a horseman, you notice, you can pick up if someone else is a horseman, and that's, and it shows in the barrels more than a lot that, I mean, you have to be a true horseman. Everybody who is, man, woman, whatever. I mean, you've certainly got to be a horseman. These people who say these ignorant, outdated statements, I don't think they're horsemen. I think that's probably part of it.
I don't know what goes into making those horses. And more of it is, especially in the barrel race, and I think it's so much on the horse. Those older horses that are getting rodeoed on, like, you have to have a great one. You're not going to take a mediocre horse and go win on it at that level anyway. So I think when you understand how much of it is the horse, like I said, I did go back and look at some of those things that one guy was saying, how the men have an advantage. And to me, I've seen men, women, kids of all shapes and sizes win. So I don't really see that. I'm not really understanding where he's coming from there. But it's, if you have a great one, it's, that horse is going to figure out a way to do it. And if you don't, it's not. Like, you might sneak runs in here and there. You can kind of man make it. But at the end of the day, 5 years down the road, it's going to be what it's going to be. So yeah. I think that, in that sense, I guess I'm trying to say, I think it's more on the horse than it is the person. I mean, the person has to do, you know, like you said, be a horseman and train the horse and stuff. But at the end of the day, that horse has to be able to do it.
Well, that's all barrel racing is, right? I mean, it's no different than quarter horse racing or even, you know, thoroughbred racing. I mean, it's a showcase of the animal at the end of the day. And someone has to jockey that animal, right? But it's funny because people are like, because you did some cool stuff in that run, right? You know, you picked the barrel up, you did some things, you did some athletic barrel racing moves, and it's like, oh, his arms are longer, he's this, he's that. I got deep into it because I was just in that perfect mood and just happened to be looking at Facebook. I'm like, not this bullshit again. But then you go and you watch Emily on the last day, and she freaking picks a barrel up, lifts both legs over, and no one cares. Like, she just did the exact same thing, you know, albeit maybe a little different. And, you know, what's the difference? Yeah. I mean, I don't see how a man could have a distinct advantage. This is a risky thing to say. You don't have an advantage over Haley Kinzel. She weighs 14 pounds.
Yeah. You know, and is good at what she does.
And it's great. Yeah.
Well, that, you ever seen the picture of Jolene winning Fort Smith on Robin's Mare?
Yep.
Their legs about, she could probably kick herself in the face if she wanted to.
Like, have you seen Jolene's freaking biceps? She could probably punch you in the face and you won't wake up.
I won't talk bad to Jolene. She'd probably whoop my ass.
Yeah. I mean, she's like,
I don't know that I could take her.
I wouldn't even try. Even if I could, I don't think I'd want to risk the injuries that I get, even if I was successful.
That'd probably be really bad for me on Facebook if I let her whip my ass and be a barrel racer.
You might not get bothered anymore. It's like, all right, jury's out. He's fine. Never mind. Yeah. We'll let him in. What would you think? Because one thing that got kind of sparked during all of this, I don't want to call it controversy because it's a freaking tale as old as time. Like, and there's been men in barrel racing since the 60s, 50s, 60s, or and Dale men Urien. Training. What's that?
Dale Urey, like
50s. The 50s. Yeah, that's what it was. And men have always trained barrel horses. And it's funny because even if you see women like Jordan Briggs or even Ivy, right, their husbands will take their colts through the barrels for them and no one bats an eye. But as soon as a guy gets on and wins something, it's a problem in Texas.
Yeah.
Like, you can't come to Texas and do that queer stuff. Yeah. It's like, this is crazy. It's just crazy, and I'm probably going down this whole thing too much, but you're here, and like, I don't know when somebody else is going to be here to talk about it, so I was like, I want to get this out and ask, because this is one of the things that came up. A lot of people said, well, why don't the men just set up their own barrel racing organization inside rodeo? Is that something that would even interest someone like you?
No.
I don't see how. I don't know anybody who would even want that.
I mean, and too, like, I don't have any desire to go rodeo. That's just me personally. So I mean, it doesn't bother me that I can't.
Right.
The only time that I would like to is the horses that I have. If I could take them to rodeos and prove that the rodeo horses just to sell.
Right.
That would be my only reason too. But I have no desire to go down the road like that.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that one year I had the stud. I went all over the country with him because he was winning, and it was nothing like a rodeo. I didn't go near as many places as they do. And I mean, I was tired for about 2 years. Like, that was a lot of driving.
Yeah.
But I don't know. That's just me personally. There's probably other people out there that really want to do it. But just me, myself, that's just not what it interests me. So I guess I never really put too much thought into it because unless you get on Facebook, I don't see it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you're kind of in your own world, just like everybody else is. doing what you decided to do to make a living. And I think that's, at the end of the day, you chose a discipline that you could succeed at. But is it because you like specifically the barrel horse, the athlete, and the athletic pursuit of that horse? Is that why you think barrel racing maybe was the thing that you thrived in the most, or you liked the most, just because of how, I mean, you can appreciate that horse almost more than any other athletic animal because of what you're asking them to do?
Oh, definitely. Like, appreciating that horse is, I've been lucky enough to have like a handful, like, and ride more than a handful, probably of really like great horses, I'd say. And I've rode a lot of them that are not so great. So then there's way more of those. So that one that really does it, and especially one like Sharpie and some other ones I had, just Sharpie because I just got off of him. I mean, to be able to jump on a horse like him and then him win how he did, that's him. Like, I don't care how good anybody, me or what I think I am or anybody else, I wouldn't have done that if it wasn't that horse. So, like, to me, that horse deserves more of the credit than me for doing all that. But, so I guess I can, like I said, appreciate the horse that way. And, yeah, about the other stuff, I have roped. I bought a rope horse there a while ago, then Emily made me sell it because it was just sitting out in the broodmare pasture. But, like, I like that a lot. I enjoy it. It's fun. But it's not what I wake up every day wanting to do. Like, when I wake up in the morning, I'm, like, ready. The reason I get out of bed is to go train the colts. Like, that's – I love it. I mean, originally I started out, I wanted to rope, but if you told me now I could have picked one or the other, I would still choose barrel horses again.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's – whenever we talk about them, right, we don't ever refer to it as barrel racing. We're talking about the horse. Everything's about the horse, and especially young horses, because when you take a two-year-old, you know, you probably send yours off. You're probably not jumping on two-year-olds. No one who does it well does that because it's too much of a risk. But when you get to see an animal progress, and the cool thing about barrel horses, and I've ridden enough of them at every single level where I feel confident talking about it with you, is that you can watch this progression in a very linear fashion. And obviously some horses are going to progress quicker than others, but there's always this point, right? And for some horses, it's like, it could be like 3 days in. For some, it's 6 months where something just clicks.
Yeah.
Right. And then you know that, man, this process, this progress, and you can speak on it as good as anyone, it works.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Some of them, they have their ups and downs for sure, but, and I felt it in all different stages. Like that Sucker Punch, he was the first probably great one I've like trained, and I got on him. Robin got him back from the Colt Breaker, and Lewayne, he's up in Pennsylvania, he's broke a bunch of the ones I've rode and went on. He like does a great job, and I've been able to ride a lot behind him. And this horse, I stepped on him and I pulled the rein. Within, like, 2 seconds, I was like, oh, wow. Like, I don't know what that was, but that feels better than I've ever felt on a horse before. Like, that was, I mean, it was a different progress through there, but, like, that was the first one. I just touched him and felt him come through himself, and I was like, well, that's what a great horse feels like. And then other ones, like the stud, that Mr. Kelly stud, he was, and I think because more so he was a stud, not because of his abilities. He started out pretty good, but never had that, like, wow, there's that. And then I struggled. They took him home to breed him. And I struggled for a long time with him when I got him back. Just like he was trying different things, paying attention. He was kind of struggling with that. And then I think it was one day, like end of August, I took him through the barrels at home and I felt it. And I was like, there it is. Like, this one's got it.
The same old story with studs. If you send them to collect or do anything like that, it takes forever for their brains to come back to reality.
Yeah. It's tough. I've only ever had one come back calm and relax, and I was like, well, that works for him, but that's never been the experience I've had with him.
Have you ridden a lot of studs?
A handful, probably 5 or 10, or maybe, well, probably 10 or 15, or I'm not really sure, but I've only had, that's the only really good one I've had, and I've had others go through and, like, be decent horses, but that's the only one that, like, I've won decent money on.
Yeah, it's real rare for studs to make, right?
Yeah,
I mean, unless you, like, you get in the situation that Jolene was in and everything, where it was just everything was amazing.
But yeah.
Every stud I've always rode was, like, a subpar everything.
Yeah, they're tough. They're tough for sure. I have a couple 3-year-olds at home that I like a lot, and spring's coming and I can feel them changing, but they still feel pretty good. I have high hopes for them. They're the best couple I've had in a long time, but it's definitely a lot harder for them. like mentally and physically, like not going into too much detail. Like it's when it's hot, their balls drop and it makes it hard for right. them to like, usually it'll be one direction that they don't want to hold their inside hind leg in. And when it's hotter, obviously they go farther, the temperature control thing of the body or whatever. So it's a lot harder, and they guard themselves. And I think if you don't watch it, like you can get them sore there, and then they really want to quit using their hind end. So I think that's what makes it pretty hard physically. And then mentally, their mind's on you. A good one, their mind's on you, but they're also out the corner of their eye, they're kind of checking everything else out. And whether it be a mare or another horse, or their mind's not 100% on you all the time, I feel like, anyway.
Yeah, no. Yeah, there's always this sense of, like, nervousness whenever you get on a stud, because you don't know what they're going to do, because
yeah.
they'll do things where they'll stand up on their hind legs for 30 seconds, or they'll bolt with you, or they'll be perfect. You yep. just never know with a stud. I mean, I've never enjoyed them, personally.
Yeah.
Most people don't.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I can appreciate a winner, for sure. But even the Mr. Kelly stud, I begged Robin to cut him.
Really?
Yeah. I wanted to cut him so bad. Glad we didn't.
Right. Yeah, no
kidding.
If
he was mine, he wouldn't have been a stud.
Right.
But it's a lot of work. But it's obviously for him, it was way worth it in the long run.
Yeah.
I mean, we have a couple colts at home out of him, or one on the ground and then one on the way. And I've seen a bunch of them on the internet, and they're good looking horses. Then to being out of the mare that he's out of, I mean, I would think he'd produce.
Right.
So, I mean, I think it was a smart choice to keep him a stud.
Yeah, you're glad she didn't listen to you?
Yeah, that's happened a lot.
Yeah, so what do you look for? Like, how choosy are you with taking in outside horses? And this is getting pretty technical, but more technical than I thought it would. But what are you looking for, like, when you're taking an outside horse? Will you take anything in for an allotted amount of time, or at this point in your career, because you can be, are you pretty choosy?
First thing I look for is a good owner. Like, I'll ride for an owner more than I'll ride for a horse. Like, just because I've been down the road, and it's a pain when you have one that you know is good, and then the owner won't do what needs to be done to take care of it or put him where he needs to be. And that's just frustrating. You might as well not have the horse. Or if an owner doesn't trust you and they question everything you do, it makes it really hard to train one. So, like, to be honest, I mean, no, it's not about a horse, but I'm way more choosy on my owners than my horses.
Sure.
And then after that, like, something that's bred pretty well, or something I know that I get along with. And if I don't think I do, then I'll tell them up front that I don't know. Like, typically don't get along with this, but every horse is different. And then confirmation-wise, I've had so many different horses built, so different and not so good, some really good. I really have no idea what works.
Right.
Like, it's that cornerstone horse, when Sarah bought him, so somebody else showed me a video of him. I was like, that thing looks terrible. I was like, I don't think that was a good buy. Like, just, and he's just kind of really narrow, kind of looked like a giraffe, and just kind of straight behind, and just something that I didn't really think much of him. Then when she got sick, they asked me to take him, and I took him, and I had him about 6 months, and he would make really fast runs. Like, Kendall had some, I think she ran like almost made it back in the buyback in the Derby. I think it was one out or something. So, like, he would run, make real fast runs, but he was kind of inconsistent. But then once he finally got it together and then went, and then he went to winning like he did. And that's what I told Sarah. Same deal. If it was me, I wouldn't have bought him, or I wouldn't have picked him.
Right.
But that goes back to, I think, a great horse is a great horse. Like, they find a way.
Yeah.
If that will to win is in them, then they'll figure it out, no matter how they're made or what's on in front of them.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing that if you geek out on horses or breeding or anything, you find, like, these trends in the bloodlines and things like that. Do you get pretty deep into breeding, or?
Yes and no. Like, there's definitely breeds I really like. Then, and more so, I want to, if I get real excited about one, it's because of the horse's mother. If that mare had done something or produced a lot, that's when I get more excited about them. But, I mean, I do a little bit just because, like, I've had so many different kind of breedings, too. Like, Stoney's a Brookstone Bay, and Leslie's won a bunch on a couple of them. But other than that, you don't see a bunch of those. And I've rode a couple others that they weren't him. And then Dash to Fame's, like, one of the best horses I rode was, like, Sucker Punch is a Dash to Fame. And probably one of the worst horses I've ever rode was a Dash to Fame, too. So there's no black and white. It's all, I guess, all relative, or depends on the individual.
Yeah, yeah. So you're one of the few who doesn't get too dogmatic in the breeding. I mean, you kind of have to a little bit now, right, with these fraternities, the ruby buckles, the pink buckles, the royal crowns. I mean, you're almost forced into these boxes, right?
That, yeah.
And we've talked about that a lot lately on the show just because the royal crown just happened and it was not a good thing. But that you're stuck in a way, right, as an owner, a stallion owner, or even – and by default, a competitor, right? Like a competitor is stuck in that box too, if the owners and the stallion owners are, because then it really limits like your earning potential from winnings.
Oh,
if
definitely.
You don't go to those things.
Yeah. I know this year, most of them are in that I colts I have, or most of them are in a lot of incentives. But next year, my favorite colts that I have for next year so far, I mean, that changes a lot, but they're not in anything. Like one's actually a thoroughbred out of a Dash to Fame mare, a stud, and like he's real cool, but he's a thoroughbred. He's not in any incentive, so he's gonna have to win all his at the BFA and stuff like that. And then I don't know, I guess the top four that I have right now, they're not in anything, so that kind of hurts you in a way. Like they won't be able to run the pink buckle and the ruby buckle. There's a lot of money that they won't be able to run at, and they might be great horses, but
I don't think it devalues them quite a bit, like just in the marketplace today. I mean, that's another big topic is anybody who calls, it doesn't matter if they want a $20,000 horse or a $500,000 horse, the first thing they say is they need to be paid up, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yes and no. For probably the older that they get, the less they'll worry about it if they're great horses. But, like, for resale, it definitely, I don't know if it hurts the other ones, but it definitely helps the ones that are in it. Like, you could probably sell a lesser horse for more just because it's in a pink buckle or the Breeders' Challenge or all that stuff.
Yeah. So if you're giving advice to somebody, would you say, like, they're looking for a good horse, right? And maybe they're just your typical person who wants to go win some money or do whatever. They don't want to hit the road or do anything like that. You'd recommend ignoring those incentive horses?
Probably so. Yeah. If you're not worried about that, then there really is no, I mean, look at the individual more so than the breeding at first. But like, besides, well, Jason and Leslie, they buy a lot, like, track horses. But heck, he always says he looks at the horse first and the paper second. That papers are secondary. So if you're just looking for a horse like that, just look at the horse and see if it's something that looks like you want to ride and then see what it's bred like.
Yeah.
But if you're going to breed and to resell or something, you kind of have to. Like, and well, back to Cody, too, he said he won't buy or ride anything that isn't in those because he doesn't want to miss the chance at running at that money.
Right. Well, I mean, that's a big factor, right? Because there might be like a misconception with a lot of younger people maybe who think they want to do this for a living, right? Like that it's some cash king kind of industry. And yeah, I learned at about 12 years old that no, it is not.
Yeah.
Right. But
you want to love this because to do it, you don't do it for the money.
Right. Right. And people don't understand that, right? They just see you running at the American and things like that, or they see these big checks at places like the pink buckle, the ruby buckle, and it like romanticizes the struggle a little bit, maybe, right?
Yeah.
Or maybe the whole thing, and they don't realize the struggle. Maybe I said that wrong, but I mean, I think you probably know more people probably than even I do who think they want to do it, and then they spend a whole bunch of money, and then they halfway dip their toe into it. I mean, what advice would you give somebody, you know, man, woman, whatever, if they want to do what you do for a living or a lot of, you know, our mutual friends do for a living?
Be ready to be on a budget because don't do it for the money. For one, it's not very lucrative. It's a constant struggle, but like you have to really be 110% in it. Like, well, I was talking to somebody at the American, and we were talking about being from Maryland. They're like, there's probably a lot of fun stuff to do up there. I was like, maybe, but I really don't know because all we do is ride. So right. I don't really go out or do anything else. This is what we do all day, every day. So I don't know. I think that's, you have to be in it for the long haul. You got to be a slave to it, really.
Yeah.
So be prepared for that. And if you don't really want to do it and really love it, then you won't be very happy very long.
Yeah, we're probably successful at all.
Yeah. Yeah, because everybody else is out there doing it. You kind of have to, they're doing it that way. Every waking moment, they're thinking about it. And if you're not like that, they're going to beat you.
What was your childhood like? I kind of just wonder. I always wonder, somebody who becomes a barrel horse trainer, or actually any horse trainer at all, I always wonder about their childhood.
Pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, we grew up on a farm. the family's farm had it for like late 1800s or something.
Really?
Like we had that group text I was talking about.
Yeah.
It's there's three different families. Three of my dad had like a family that he was one of eight, and there's three of them lived. The brothers lived on the farm, and all our cousins were about the same age. Well, we had a pretty big family, like 20 some cousins on that side, but there's eight or nine of us right there. So growing up, we always hung out with each other, and it was pretty good. Then, and Dad, they raised tobacco. So, like, I remember from the time I was probably about four or five till like about 15 or so when they took the buyout, that the state paid them not to grow tobacco anymore. But we did that every summer, and that probably, I hated it at first, but looking back, it probably put a good work ethic in me because, like I said, we were out there. It's pretty hard labor, and we were out there all the time doing it. So I guess them raising me like that, it looked like it was rough at first, but I think it really benefited me.
Yeah, dude, I couldn't imagine. I remember, like, my mom and dad, they rode for someone. They literally moved us from Colorado to North Carolina, Shelton's, to
Yeah.
They did tobacco and, like, cotton and all that, and that looked brutal.
Yeah, it's not the most fun I've ever had, but
it's a little less glamorous even than barrel horse training.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Probably more lucrative, but
probably at the bottom line. Yeah, but
not a whole lot of fun to do it.
Right. With the whole, like, because you've made it back in the American, what, three times now? Three or four?
This is the fifth time.
Fifth time. When did you decide that you were going to go that route in those qualifiers? Because, I mean, a decent amount of people do it, but not as many guys do it as you.
Well, I think the first time I went, I'm not sure. I made it on, I won or qualified on Robin's mare, the one the Cheyenne's running now, that Misty. And then I ran the Foxy mare there, and like it wasn't, didn't end up, I think she fell down or something. Like I had good, like that one horse, the Misty horse is a great horse. And Foxy was a really good horse, but she was a 4-year-old at the time, so it wasn't the best situation for her. So then the next year I kind of tried to go, but didn't get anything done. Then the year after that is when all those horses started really like making, and I had those great, really like a great set of horses. So it kind of just made sense to go try, and it just kept working out. But that's probably why, the reason I guess I went, because I thought I had a good shot at winning it because of those horses that I had in the barn.
You've had probably more success at the American than any of the other fraternity trainers I can think of. I mean, other than Cassie's had a lot of success. She qualified two horses, but I mean, when I think of like fraternity trainers who show up and run against the top rodeo people every year at the American, I always think of you. And obviously there's a handful of them that do it, but I mean, you've made it back in the top eight, and you've even made it in the top four a couple times, didn't you?
Yeah, twice.
And it's just not a lot of people from the fraternity industry make it that. And how different is it, though, running in a place like AT&T and going through that more rodeo setup and rodeo process than obviously it's way different than a fraternity?
That's nothing like I've ever run at before, and still that way. It's and the weird setups, and like underneath the tunnel there, you're just standing out on asphalt, and then in the warm-up there's just a set of panels that has about 12 inches of sand that's super deep that you can kind of trot around, lope around a little bit, but you can't tune on your horse like you would at a fraternity. Then you just go down that concrete hill and run out into this huge stadium. So it's a little unreal, like way different than anything I've ever been to or used to or anything like that.
I mean, last year it was the craziest looking thing in the world. And what was that setup like with that thing in the middle with the ranger on top? I remember seeing it. I was like, this is a bad idea.
Yeah.
So bad they didn't do it again.
Yeah, it was different. And I understand that it seems like every year it changes, like a lot of things change, little things here and there. So I think they're constantly just trying to make it better. And I know like the first couple years I made it, it was set up with the two arenas, and then you came sideways in there, and it was there. And the alleyway was really short, and I didn't like that because it was hard to like turn the corner, get your horse set up and take off. I felt like I never could get a good first barrel there. It kind of would shove me out in the middle of the pen, and I couldn't get him to stick a inside leg to come around. But so then I was kind of happy when they changed it because it was a different setup, but then it kind of made you run right at the first barrel, and just the alleyway was like headed one direction and the barrels were set the other direction. So it was the weirdest setup I've ever been in, but I understand it, like they're trying to make it better, but that's a weird place to set up an arena. So I guess they're just doing the best they can with what they got.
Yeah, I mean, they listen to people, and they seem to be trying. I mean, there's only so much you can do with a giant football stadium, yeah. I guess, as far as where they can come from and go. But, I mean, it prompts another interesting question, right? Like, lots of people enter these things, but it's just these rodeo girls have a distinct advantage over pretty much everybody else in the industry when it comes to things like that, right? Because they're so used to the unconventional setups.
Yeah, probably so. And then, like, if you're coming in from the NFR, you don't have to run at the north side first. You don't have all those runs in front of you. And then it's definitely different that way. And then when they have those weird setups, like, it's usually the rodeo girls that are telling the trying to get the guys setting the pattern up to change a little bit here and there to make it more easier for everybody. But really, it's probably wrong for them to do that, because the weirder the setup, the probably more the advantage goes to them.
Right.
So it's really helping us out coming in from Northside or the ones that aren't used to rodeo, and they're giving us more of a, taking their advantage away and trying to give it to us.
Yeah.
But it's definitely, it's different. Like, it's tricky. Like, I was trying to sit in the back, and I'll get a game plan in my mind about what I'm going to do and how I'm going to approach the barrels. But then, and I try not to watch too much, or so I don't get something different in my head. But I was watching them, different ones going into the barrels or taking off in the alleyway. Like, I couldn't, where I was sitting, I couldn't see the barrels, but I could see how they went down the alley and how they took off to the first barrel. And it was real interesting, the different people, how they would do it. Like, some I saw would pick a straight line, which, like, hug the inside and kind of take off out to the middle. Then some would just go far left and just kind of, like, threw them out in a big pocket. And it will, different ways, different work, different for people. I guess they know their horses better than anybody, and they've been in those situations, so they knew how to do it. But it was pretty interesting just watching them take off from behind the alleyway and how they set their horses up for the first barrel, that with that one being so tricky.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. And I just, you know, everybody in the final four last night, they all were at Globe Life, and that was not nearly the same, but it was funky. And, you know, I always wonder how much success they have because they're so used to those unconventional setups, because there's so many rodeos with so many weird setups. And if you go to any jackpot or any fraternity derby, they're all going to be pretty dang similar.
Yeah, that's for sure.
More groomed. You know, the courses maybe don't have to necessarily be as, I don't know, I don't want to say gritty, because there's some gritty-ass fraternity horses going right now, but just in general, just it creates an interesting dynamic.
You can set your horse up a lot better for success when you're at a fraternity. There's a lot less obstacles in your way, I guess the best way to say it. Where at a rodeo, they got to, you know, be able to just handle anything.
Yeah, did you watch the tie-down last night?
I didn't. I was riding, trying to.
You saw what happened, though?
Yeah,
heard?
I heard, yeah.
Could you imagine that?
That's rough.
When the whole thing, I mean, $1.1 million and his hand was about an inch away from his reins.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about somebody like, you talk about these horses and everything. That's a perfect example, different event, but a perfect example of, you know, what it takes to be a good rodeo horse, because that horse crumbled.
Yeah.
It just crumbled. You know, there was noise or whatever it was, and just that guy had roped through the entire same process you went through, Hunter did, and had roped decent amount of times, but not like these pro rodeo guys where they're time and time again on these horses. And to go out there, he didn't know he had won it, but he had a pretty good idea, I'm sure, that yeah. No one was going to rope more than a 7-2. And then Shane Hanchy goes, Tough Cooper goes. I couldn't imagine that, being a guy like that coming through that whole process. And the reason I bring it up to you is because you've been through this process so many times. I mean, how crazy would that be? And you would never know in the barrel racing. It's different, but...
Yeah, well, I'm sure it hasn't hit him yet. It will in a day or so.
Yeah.
The first year I made it, I would have won it, but drug a barrel.
Yep.
And it was about 2 days later that it kind of sunk in. Like, it was like, it wasn't for a million. It was like, I think 400 or something. But I still think about it. It's heartbreaking. And coming through, I'm not exactly sure how theirs works, but I'm sure it's pretty similar. But coming through there, like that sudden death feeling, like every run has to be your best run. Like, you can't make a mistake. And it puts a lot of pressure on you just to kind of get through all that. And then when you're finally there, it's exciting and relaxing once you're like, okay, I made it. But then it starts all over again, especially now that there's 2 days of it where you got to do it three times in a row again. You got to be perfect three times to win.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what factor – especially in the barrel racing, does that 8-man run and then about an hour later going right into the 4-man? I mean, your horse, what do you notice?
I think that depends on the horse too. The 2 years that I made it to the 4-round, it was the year that they only had it the 1-day one. They didn't have it set up for two, but we did still have to go up and wait. And I don't know. Those are the first 2 years I made it. It was a little more. The horse, I was a sucker punch horse that I was running then, and he handled it great. Like both years, I think I drug barrels both years in the finals. But he to win one and second the other, like he handled it perfect. But I don't know, going up there sitting and it's kind of like you're excited and you're happy. You just had a good run and you're kind of riding that high. And then I don't know, when you're on a horse like him, it's pretty. I don't know. I felt super confident in him. Just didn't do anything different. Just tied him to the trailer, gave him water, and waited. Then warmed him up for a second. Went down there and felt like same horse. But that is the only time I've ever run twice in a day is there.
Right.
But I guess it depends on your horse is where your confidence lies.
Yeah.
If you're on a really solid horse, you feel pretty good about it. If you know your man made your run, then you're probably sweating it on that second run.
Yeah. How much of a gut grinding experience is it going to be next year with $2 million on the table? Yeah.
Well, when we left there, I told Emily, I said, I don't think I'm going to go to a qualifier this year. I think five times was enough. They gave me enough chances to win, and I just don't think it's going to happen right now. And then Cody texts me, and he said, I was riding. He says, $2 million next year. And I'm like, well, maybe I will try.
I wonder. I mean, I bet the qualifiers and everything this next year are going to be out of control.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody's going to enter them from everywhere. It'd be stupid not to.
Yeah.
Because even if you split it.
Yeah, you're still splitting double. Even if everybody wins, you're still getting double what you would have the year before.
Yeah, so, I mean, I hope they don't change the rules on qualifying multiple horses for a third time.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. That was different, the way they did that. But, I don't know, there was a ton of barrel racers already. So, I don't know if that number's going to go up even more or not. It seems like everybody that has a horse entered a qualifier.
Right.
I think they took, was it 280 in the long round?
Yeah, something like that. Almost 300, yeah.
Yeah, that's the most I've ever remember being there.
Yeah.
So I don't know how much big it can get, but.
Maybe double.
Yeah.
Okay, well, so for the final thing, what are you going to say to all these man barrel racing haters? This is the last thing. We're going to turn this into a clip for Instagram.
Oh, I don't know. Like, I really.
No, tell them what you think.
To be honest, I don't really think about them.
No, you hate them.
They don't affect me one bit. So. I mean, I guess unless they want to, I mean, I'll quit if they'll pay my bills.
There you go.
If that's what they want. I mean, they're going to have to pay me a lot, but I don't know. Like I said, it doesn't really bother me. They can have their opinion, but the ones that I've seen at the height of their game in any event, they don't have that opinion. I mean, I ride for Samantha, JB Mooney's wife, and he's been up to our farm hanging out and stuff, and he's never been weird to me. And that's the best, the richest man in Western sports. He has no problem with it. As far as I know, maybe he does and just don't say it to me, but he's never been weird to me about it.
Yeah.
So if he's cool with it, I guess I am too.
Brandon Cullen, you're a saint of a man. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks.
This has been The Gauge, hosted by me, Chance Conrado, produced and edited by our guy, Ty Yeager. Shout out to the executive producers, Dustin Pointer and Cody Denton. Marketing and content produced by Riley Chone. Our theme song is by Shay Ashire and the Night Howlers. Make sure to rate and review this podcast, as well as follow The Gauge on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And make sure to subscribe to The Gauge wherever you get your podcasts. We'll see you guys next time.